We've got KUOW producer Alec Cowan in the room. Hey, Alec.
Hey, Deb.
So what listener question are we answering today?
Well, I listened to our Thanksgiving special and was really interested in the question you answered about legendary Puget Sound bootlegger Roy Olmsted. It was so interesting. I just didn't know anything about Prohibition in Seattle, and this segment spurred me to look more into it.
Okay, cool. What did you find?
So, as it turns out, Olmsted is only part of the story. As I dug deeper, I learned that Prohibition is actually a pretty formative time in Seattle's history. So I wanted to go a little deeper and show how the fight to ban booze has some long-lasting legacies for Seattle.
Okay, I can't wait to hear this. So where do we start in this story?
Well, it's a long story filled with secrets and triumphs and tragedies. And to really get into it, I need a drink.
Do I get a drink too?
Don't worry, you get a nice tall glass of water.
Thank you.
So for this story, we're starting at a bar, a place called the Queen City Grill.
All right, that's in Belltown.
It's a kind of small place directly on the corner of First and Blanchard. The bar's slogan states that they're the oldest bar in Seattle. Maybe. My friend Peter Andrzejewski tells me it's been around since about 1890.
It's one of the few been around since before Prohibition.
Peter is an important ingredient here. Several years ago, he developed a hobby and a goal. Go to 1,000 bars in Washington and find the history behind each of them.
You know, our founding fathers spent a lot of time in taverns, right? The Marines were formed in tavern. Washington gave his farewell in a tavern.
What's important, Pete is telling me, is that saloons and bars and taverns are cultural touchstones. They're places for communities to congregate. And the history of those places tells the story of a city like nowhere else. And this is especially true for Seattle.
There are a few cultures that have just kind of disappeared that we have no trace of that I only discovered once I got into this hobby. And, you know, there's tons of, in the 30s and 40s, tons of all-night clubs with everything you imagine from speakeasy culture, you know, with the escape routes. And it was, again, it was, you know, some of the most open, famous gay locations in the United States back in the day.
So I'm not much of a nightlife person. So it's really interesting to me that bars and nightclubs would have this sort of interesting cultural history.
I think we often go into bars without ever really thinking about how it got there. Or we see those markers above the entrances to old buildings etched in stone that say, built in 1911. And we think, sure, that's cool. But we don't really feel why that even matters. We don't see the history. And that's why today we're putting on some jazz, pouring one over the rocks, and heading into the underground world of speakeasies to see how Prohibition forever changed policing in Seattle.
This is Sound Cues, a podcast fueled by listener curiosity. I'm Deborah Wong with producer Alec Cowan. On the Thanksgiving special of Sound Cues, we told you a bit about Pacific Northwest bootlegger Roy Olmsted. But there's more to the city of Seattle and Prohibition, and it has to do with a black club owner named Doc Hamilton. And that's where we're taking you in this episode of Sound Cues.
So, Deb, you already learned a little bit about Prohibition with our Thanksgiving episode on Roy Olmsted.
Yeah, Olmsted was a bootlegger. He basically operated with impunity because he bought off the police, and he had this huge influence on the Pacific Northwest.
Exactly. He's now kind of a local legend. But what's important here is there's another side of the story. And it starts off with the origin of Prohibition and how difficult the law would be to enforce.
World War I is over, and so are America's days of legal alcoholic drink. Convinced that self-sacrifice...
So, it's the early 1900s. So much of America is changing. There's this Industrial Revolution, and that's bringing the country closer together through things like railroads. And cities are now starting to develop into metropolises. But along with all that newfound opportunity comes the darker side of things. A powerful group of people start to fight against the things they see as harmful to America. Things like prostitution, violence, and the biggest problem of all, drinking.
With the bar lined with the boys and bums, spending their money, debauching their characters, rotting their bodies, and jeopardizing their immortal souls.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. The boys and the bums jeopardizing their immortal souls. I guess this was the temperance movement?
This is the temperance movement. And against all odds, this movement is able to lobby the federal government to pass the 18th Amendment, effectively banning all alcohol in the United States. This is the beginning of Prohibition, and it would prove to be particularly difficult for Seattle.
So before Prohibition, starting in the late 1890s was the Alaskan Gold Rush. And that's when gold was discovered up in Alaska, and it triggered this gold rush, and Seattle became the port city for this gold rush.
This is Brad Holden. He's a local historian, urban archaeologist, and is the author of Seattle Prohibition, Bootleggers, Rum Runners, and Graft in the Queen City.
This prompted a bunch of saloons, brothels, gambling parlors opening. So leading up to Prohibition, Seattle was a crazy place. It was kind of the vice capital of the world.
I'm meeting Brad on Capitol Hill, right off the corner of 11th and Pike. Today, there's a gallery on the ground floor, and up above is a dispensary called WikiLeafs. But 90 years ago...
This used to be known as Auto Row. So there's a lot of garages and auto shops here, and it was a garage at that point.
We're here because he's showing me an old newspaper clipping from the Seattle Times, published on February 24th, 1925.
On the second floor of a garage at 1115 East Pike Street, in the heart of the automobile district, a moonshine still of 350 gallons capacity was seized and destroyed by divisional prohibition agents under F.A. Hazeline yesterday afternoon. The still was in operation when the agents entered the room, while close by were five 500-gallon copper vats filled with mash.
Filled with mash? Okay, what's mash?
Mash is just a big stew that you put together to create moonshine. It's all the ingredients mashed together and left to ferment.
In addition to that, they had 155-gallon equipment, a finished product in kegs. So it was a large-scale moonshine operation.
So he's calling this moonshine, which I guess means because alcohol was banned, everyone is making their own alcohol?
Exactly. Everything was illicit, done behind closed doors, hidden in basements, done with secret passwords. And because there was such a complicated system, you got a lot of glory for catching anyone doing this underground operation. And you can see all that triumph in the original photograph from this story.
There's some gigantic moonshine stills in this old garage. At this location, there's a couple federal prohibition agents standing nearby. You know, things are looking good for them. And they're posing. This is kind of their trophy.
So it was this really big deal for police to be catching people breaking the law during Prohibition. How much of this was going on?
There was tons. You basically had an entire underground economy. And catching these people was kind of a game of cat and mouse. Basically, you had rum runners.
So basically, rum running is smuggling anything on water.
And bootleggers.
And then once it hit land, the bootleggers would kind of take over and they would distribute it throughout the city.
And basically, moonshiners would just make all this alcohol in-house?
Exactly. So you had the perfect trifecta of rum runners, bootleggers, and moonshiners. But if you wanted to partake, you had to go down to your local speakeasy.
Okay, so how were people able to get to these speakeasies, considering that you know, these agents were making massive busts. I mean, weren't people worried that they'd get caught?
Well, that's just the thing. Seattle was pretty special in regard to this. They had what was called a tolerance policy, which basically meant that the local government turned a bit of a blind eye to it all. Enforcing prohibition was taxing police forces, and the law itself was really unpopular. Local police would even refuse to take in prisoners the federal government had arrested for violating prohibition. And this is no more exemplified than in the story of bootlegger Roy Olmsted.
The king of the Puget Sound bootleggers, they called him.
Okay, we're getting into familiar territory here. Wasn't Olmsted the cop in the police force who jumped into bootlegging?
That's the exact guy. And it turns out that this is such a profitable thing for him that once he's caught, he easily posts his bail, gets out, and turns his back on policing forever, turning to bootlegging full-time.
He, at one point, his bootlegging operation was so big that he was the area's largest employer. He was kind of the Amazon of his time, if you will.
The Amazon of his time. All right, so he was able to do this, I mean, we learned earlier, because alcohol was still legal in Canada, and he'd rum-run it down to the city, right?
Exactly. And because of this tolerance policy, he could just pay off the police, pay off the mayor. And so his operation really ballooned into this huge juggernaut enterprise.
And this is really strange for me because I grew up in Chicago and hearing stories about these large criminal syndicates headed by gangsters like Al Capone. And there was this, you know, history of lawlessness, and alcohol businesses made the era pretty violent. There'd be bank heists and gun battles between rival bootleggers. But I guess that was not the experience in Seattle.
Not at all. And this is the really interesting part about Olmsted specifically. So while other cities like Chicago were seeing huge upticks in violent crime, Seattle was able to escape it. And that mostly has to do with Olmsted, who they called the good bootlegger.
So he didn't allow his men to carry guns or engage in violence. To his way of thinking, his business was so big that he could just pay people off. He didn't engage in any other stuff like prostitution, narcotics, gambling.
Olmsted would become great friends with the chief of the Seattle police. At one point, he was even sharing meals and buying off the mayor of Seattle, a guy named Doc Brown. And with so much influence, he was able to keep the city from becoming filled with those violent gun battles. He became a bit of a local icon.
Just a good guy. He was very approachable. If you saw him on the street and wanted to talk to him, he would stop and take a picture with you, shake your hand, chat with you for a bit. So he was really well-liked. He was kind of like a folk hero.
But there's a caveat to this, Deb. Even if it wasn't coming from bootleggers, 1920 Seattle did see more violence. Just not the kind other cities were witnessing.
Vice really took over, but not a lot of violence. The violence that did happen was at the hands of the Prohibition agents. They were known for being rough and tumble. They were kind of shoot first and ask questions later kind of approach to capturing people.
And we're still seeing the repercussions of this police violence in Seattle, even today. That's after the break.
On the Radioactive Youth Media Podcast, teens tell stories we're not hearing anywhere else.
We're both queer and both brown and both Muslim.
Subscribe for stories that reflect our world.
On March 14th, we walked out of our classes. Today, we march to the streets of Seattle. And in November, we'll vote. And in a few years, you'll see us running for office.
Download the Radioactive Podcast at kow.org/podcast.
In the 1920s, one of the hottest new inventions was jazz.
So in the late teens and early 20s, there was a very small but lively and probably high-quality scene.
This is Paul DeBarros.
I write about music. I've specialized in jazz and also in Seattle jazz history.
If you wanted to see the best musicians and enjoy the greatest parties, you often had to go underground, into the belly of the 20s most notorious pastimes, the speakeasy.
And that's probably just because the proprietors of these places who were selling illegal whiskey and running a gambling game often in the basement were looking to attract people, so nothing attracts people like a little dinner and dancing.
When work ended, you'd hop on the streetcar and ride to the end of the tracks, which would take you to Jackson Street in the Central District. And where was the best place to catch a little dinner and dancing? A barbecue pit run by an esteemed restaurateur named Doc Hamilton.
So fancy, in a word, you know. His club was fancy. People dressed up. He served good liquor and apparently really, really good food. Somebody at one point said he could even make a big production out of baking a ham. You know, he was quite a showman.
With the restaurant on the main floor, you'd enter in, speak the secret password or show your membership card, and head downstairs.
The gambling was downstairs.
Alongside all the good stuff, jazz and liquor. He even rigged a series of alarms and secret buttons his bartenders could push to alert anyone of police breaking in.
Yeah, you're talking about a place where, you know, you might find the chief of police or a city councilman and being ferried in by limousine.
Jackson Street symbolized the street life of black Seattle at that particular time. Well, if you name almost any major musician from Louis Armstrong to Bessie Smith, they all made Jackson Street. They all came to Jackson Street and they all performed.
This is Dr. Quintard Taylor. He's a recently retired professor of American history at the University of Washington, and he founded and maintains a website called Black Past that collects stories of people and places significant to Black history. He's telling me about the culture of Jackson Street.
The vast majority of the people who went to his barbecue pit were white, or at least non-Black. And Seattle, I would say, was probably unique in that regard across the, if you look across the country.
Seattle was going through a really unique period of change. A lot of people were immigrating to the Northwest. You had a lot of people coming in from Asia. And the Black community in Seattle was starting to take root. In Prohibition, there was a kind of harmony or a synergy going on.
The nightclub scene catered to the entire community. I'd like to say that in many instances, it was the Asian Americans, usually Chinese Americans, who owned the nightclubs. Blacks were the performers there, and whites were the audience. And that was almost unique in terms of African-American entertainment life throughout the country at that particular time.
The nightclub scene was uniquely diverse. But for Roy Olmsted and Doc Hamilton, a divide was forming. Olmsted was white, and Hamilton was Black. There's an important part of the temperance movement that we should mention here. As the makeup of America's cities started to change, a lot of animosity and disdain started to emerge, especially toward the immigrants and the working class. And with these new immigrants coming to the country, the temperance movement started to place the perceived degeneracy of drinking on minorities.
And the Klan saw itself, ironically, as the defender of morality, and therefore the Klan would go after bootleggers, and particularly after bootleggers of color, and especially Black bootleggers.
Okay, when he's talking about the Klan, he's talking about the Ku Klux Klan. So they were supporters of Prohibition?
They were, actually. In Washington, the KKK saw its biggest influence around 1923, 3 years into Prohibition. That meant a high membership. They'd hold rallies with anywhere from 20 to 70,000 people.
To argue that Seattle wasn't affected by the Klan is sort of like arguing that Seattle's not affected by the rain.
So the Klan would accuse people of color of being bootleggers, knowing that would lead the police right to them?
Exactly. And this is where things start to get grim in the story. While bootleggers like Olmsted were ending up in prison, they'd just quickly post a bail or get out on a pardon. There was that tolerance policy I mentioned. And it was clearly fine with the city's officials for Doc Hamilton to run his club. But for a lot of the Black community in Seattle, this wasn't often the case.
The accusations made against people of color were often about the fact that they were bootleggers, and thus it became a justification for violence against them. I want that point to be very, very clear, that often these people weren't bootleggers per se, but the charge of bootlegging was enough to generate a violent reaction to them.
And this extended far past the KKK. Because enforcing prohibition was so tough, there was little to stop the police from just doing what they wanted, and that had long-reaching effects. Dr. Taylor points to the increased policing of the 1920s as a moment when things started to change for Seattle's Black community on a grand scale.
In point of fact, Seattle probably had less discrimination against African Americans in 1900 or even 1910 than there would be in the 1930s or 1940s or even in the 50s and early 60s. That I've often said that in some ways Seattle needs to go back to the future. And by going back to the future, I mean not necessarily that there was a golden era of race relations, but that the situation for African Americans actually became worse in Seattle as we got further and further into the 20th century. Segregated housing, for instance, began to emerge in the 1920s. Black businesses in the 1920s increasingly saw themselves limited to a Black clientele, and thus many of them remained very, very small and marginal. So much so that, you know, by World War II, Seattle looked like every other northern city in terms of its pattern of discrimination, even if the Black community itself was small.
As Alec, that is so interesting to think about a golden era of race relations in the city at the turn of the last century. But let's go back to Doc Hamilton's story. How does it all end?
Well, we're going to hear what happened to Doc Hamilton in just a minute. But first, I want to tell you about the end of Roy Olmsted's story for some important context.
Okay, so what happened with Roy?
So Roy Olmsted's reputation started to precede him. Even if the local Seattle government was willing to indulge in his bootlegging, the federal government quickly saw that Seattle had a lot of alcohol flowing through it.
And so federal agents, as they are wont to do, got wind of this and set about trying to catch Mr. Olmsted.
This is Robert Black. He's the senior fellow for constitutional content at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia.
And over the course of several months, a large number of federal agents listened to these wiretap, listened in on all of the calls that were being made, took hundreds and hundreds of pages of notes on what was being said in these calls.
Okay, so he's talking about wiretapping. Was it legal to do that?
Well, yes. But that mostly gets decided with Olmsted's case. He goes through several different courts, and they end up all siding with the police. And in the end, federal agents are charged with upholding the law. And if the law says it's illegal to possess alcohol, you have to find very creative ways to enforce it.
Possessing alcohol is not as visible, right, conduct as a lot of crimes. If you kill someone, you leave a dead body behind, and then the police will search off of that. But we don't necessarily know that somebody has alcohol in their home or in their car or anything like that. So law enforcement becomes much more aggressive in a number of ways.
This is what Brad Holden meant when he said that police were more shoot first, ask questions later. It was mostly about catching criminals and not worrying about how you caught them. So Olmsted actually ends up appealing all the way to the Supreme Court.
Okay, what does the court decide?
They also side with the police. So Olmsted gets sent to prison, but it isn't all bad. While he's in prison, he converts to Christian Science. President Franklin D. Roosevelt eventually pardons him, and when he gets out, he dedicates the rest of his life to preaching about the dangers of alcohol.
Which sounds like a pretty big reversal for him.
It was a major reversal. And what ends up happening is in 1967, the court basically reverses their opinion and they end up totally vindicating Olmsted. But the tactics that the police used to get him are what's important here, especially for Doc Hamilton.
For Doc Hamilton. Okay, so tell us more about him and how does his story end?
So he also ends up getting caught by the police. He receives a sentence of 5 years in prison, which was actually a really harsh penalty at the time. But he also gets pardoned, like Olmsted, after spending about 3 months in federal prison out in Walla Walla.
But it seemed to have broken his spirit. He apparently tried to get back into the game and never really did.
This is Paul DeBarros again.
I do know that when he got out of prison, he became a farmer in Auburn. And he made several unsuccessful attempts to reopen his club in various places in town and died in 1942.
So from what you're telling us, it seems like Olmsted and Hamilton were really alike in many ways. They were both very revered in their communities. They were considered some of the classiest people fighting prohibition. And they were both really rich in their time before they got caught.
And not only that, but they were lucrative business partners. They both interacted with each other. But in the end, it was race that made them different. I think we have a lot of nostalgia for the 1920s, from the bourgeois parties, the jazz. But this was the birth of organized crime across the United States, and we still pay reverence to that with movies like The Godfather and Scarface. I mean, most of us all know who Al Capone is.
Yeah, especially those of us who grew up in Chicago.
Exactly. But one of the enduring legacies of the era was the invention of the gangster and the bootlegger, of a respect for breaking the law. While Seattleites were praising Roy Olmsted as the good bootlegger, there was a lot of celebration when Doc Hamilton was arrested. There's this Seattle Times cartoon that Pete Andrzejewski came across in his bar research, and it depicts a blackface caricature of Hamilton being run out of town by police. And as he's running, he's saying this really crude phrase in dialect.
That's so interesting and so unfair that they were depicted so differently. I mean, considering that they were very much alike.
Well, for minorities in the working class, people like Doc Hamilton were just providing a place for community. But the way black criminals were portrayed at the time was very different from people like Olmsted, who were folk heroes. And also, the idea of what makes a gangster has changed since Doc Hamilton. It's come to mean a lot more than just organized crime and bootlegging.
The caveat I want to add here is that it's a little bit more complicated than that. That in the black community, the gangsters were in many instances revered, much as white gangsters were revered in the white community. You know, in other words, this notion of criminality automatically being bad, being recognized as bad in the entire community, has to be challenged by the fact that the black gangsters did what Al Capone did. They essentially provided largesse. They provided turkeys at Thanksgiving. They provided food. They helped to supplement people's income when people needed it.
For Dr. Taylor, the lessons of Prohibition are about some of the ways we look at criminality. This was a time when people believed the law was broken. Prohibition was trying to fix something that a few people believed to be immoral, which ended up creating more problems than it ended up solving. So crime starts to take on a bit of a new meaning because of that legacy.
None of these people were Robin Hood. Okay, let's be clear. None of them were Robin Hood. They weren't stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. But certainly there were a lot of people who were willing to look the other way because Doc Hamilton provided services and or help. And I think that same thing holds true for gangsters throughout the country.
He said in 1932 when he was sentenced, he said, "Your Honor, sir, you know that the laws are unjust. And that because I am a colored man, I can shine shoes or scrub floors or cook for somebody. But that if I try to rise above that position, the public is against me. If I go to the penitentiary, sir, there will be 25 people who will starve to death. They are my father, my mother, my children, and my employees. If you send me to the penitentiary, sir, God himself will curse you for it."
Wow, that is a really powerful statement from Doc Hamilton. And it sort of underlines this idea that, you know, if you look at the history of Prohibition through the lens of race or race relations, it's really, really complicated.
Prohibition was about many things, much more than just alcohol. It's about a crucial pivot for people like Doc Hamilton. It's about long-lasting changes to Seattle. The tolerance policy was eventually abused by the police to extort people, and it wasn't until 1969 that the federal government had to step in to stop the practice from the Seattle Police Department.
Ah, the federal government stepped in. It sounds like echoes of today.
This whole story is echoes of today. And even though Prohibition only lasted 10 years, it's a really interesting lesson. A small group of temperance supporters managed to change the Constitution in a way that tried to change human behavior. And a byproduct was the demonization of people of color. It led to increased violence, both from those breaking the law and those charged with upholding it. And we're still dealing with the legacy of that today.
That is so fascinating. Thanks so much for that really deep dive into the history of Prohibition. Alec, thanks for the story.
It's my pleasure, Deb.
To give you a heads up before we get to the credits. The Sound Cues podcast is taking a break for a little while as we figure out the best ways to keep answering your questions. While we may be off your podcast feed, your questions will still be on the airwaves and online, so keep sending them. Go to kuow.org or leave us a voicemail at 206-616-3805 and ask us your questions. Sound Cues is a production of KUOW in Seattle. Kyle Norris is our producer. Jeannie Yandel is our editor. Our production team includes Anna Boyko-Wyrock, Catherine Banwell, Gil Agutter, Jill Jackson, and Brendan Sweeney. Michael Parker composed our theme music. Extra music in this episode was by Joseph William Morgan and by Will Harrington. I'm Deborah Wong. Thank you for listening to Sound Cues. We really appreciate your support. And stay curious.